tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz?
Welcome to Friday, and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We are about to grapple with the news of this week with a live audience. We're in the process of visiting every one of Seattle's new districts, election districts, this summer, and today we are in District Number 4 at University Heights Center. That's our people at 50th and University Way, a neighborhood that might be about to get denser. This week, let's get right to it. A task force appointed by Seattle's mayor released its recommendations for keeping the city an affordable place to live. Here's the basic plan. The city would relax some zoning restrictions, more multifamily units in places, bigger buildings in others. In exchange for being able to build bigger, developers would either sell some homes at below market prices or pay a fee to the city. Current landlords would get a tax break for keeping rents down. The city would go to voters next year with about a $300 million housing levy, double the current levy. I'm going to let Mayor Ed Murray tell you why he supports all this, and he hopes you do too.
My vision is a vision where the people who work in Seattle can afford to live in Seattle. Without this plan, people will continue to be forced to move outside this city. We will continue to have a city of economic apartheid, where the various low-wage earners come to work in the day to work in this city and get on the bus or get in cars for long drives outside the city to the outer suburbs. That will result in more congestion, increased environmental degradation, the fragmentation of communities, and the fragmentation of families.
So our question for the next few minutes is, what would following this affordable housing plan do to Seattle's quality of life? On the panel, let's start with Erica C. Barnett, who covers news and gossip and urbanism at thecisforcrank.com. Erica, what would this do to our quality of life?
Well, I think it would dramatically improve quality of life for the people that, as Mayor Murray said, have to drive or take the bus from far away to get here. I also think it will dramatically increase diversity of housing and incomes in neighborhoods that are, he put it as economic apartheid, but, you know, that if you don't want to use extreme terms like that, that are really segregated. So I think it's gonna really improve our city in a lot of ways, both dramatic and subtle.
What do you say to that, Crosscut columnist, the Mossback Canute Berger?
Well, the Hala report, which we saw the final non-draft version of, you know, it'd probably be easier to implement after the 9-point quake. You know.
It would be a need for a lot of upzoning at that point.
Yeah, need for a lot of upzoning.
We'll be talking about the New York article,
you know,
presently.
All the new waterfront. Right?
Yes, the new waterfront.
The new waterfront. You know, I looked at it as a real mixed bag and an interesting way to begin to kind of focus the debate. I think we do need more housing. I think we're going to get more multifamily housing. I think there are things in the report I can agree with about channeling a lot of that into transit corridors and the rail stations and that kind of thing. You know, I'm not persuaded that the sort of blanket, it's effective, it's not technically an up zone, but it's an effective up zone of the single family neighborhoods across the city. I'm not sure that's a great strategy.
Why not?
What's that?
Why not?
Well, I think there are a number of factors. I mean, I would like to see more multifamily housing in those neighborhoods, but I just don't think doing it across the board and letting the market sort of drive it is the way to do it. I think you could do it much more strategically. And so I would like to see the plan result in something that's much more strategic. I thought there were also things in the plan that raised red flags. They want to reduce things like design review and historic districts. I like the idea of conservation districts. They don't. You know, there's good and bad in the plan, and I think it'll be a very lively debate.
We're going to talk to our third panelist, Bill Finkbeiner, as soon as I let Erica release the tension on her face, listening to Knute Berger.
Well, I think, needless to say, I don't like the idea of conservation districts because they are effectively homeowners associations, and I do think that they increase, or if we adopted them, they'd increase economic segregation in our city, which is already terrible. I also think that that allowing duplexes, which is what we're really talking about, and keeping the zoning exactly the same as it is in 94% of the city, or I'm sorry, in 94% of the single-family areas of the city, is should not be a cause for panic. It's going to allow some people, some homeowners, to decide that they want a backyard garage apartment, or that they want, you know, maybe to have two apartments or have a small lot development on their land. It's all within the current zoning. It's not the big deal that opponents are saying it is. And with regard to historic preservation, there was a building that was declined by the Historic Preservation Board in Pioneer Square that was to the existing zoning, which I think speaks to the fact that things like historic preservation and design review can actually be a place where people who just don't want development can stop development by claiming historic, historic status for buildings. And for reasons that have nothing to do with historic designation.
She didn't say NIMBY, but there's a sign floating overhead that says NIMBY.
I'm trying so hard not to say NIMBY, but I will note that it does just mean not in my backyard, and that is what a lot of people are, in fact, saying.
Let us introduce that we have the former Republican State Senate Majority Leader, Bill Finkbeiner, with us. Bill, what's your take on all this? Kirkland resident.
Right, exactly. Kirkland resident in that super dense Kirkland neighborhood that I live in. Most of the people on my street have apartments over their garage, or have mother-in-law units in the back of their garage. I think it makes it a nicer place to live. I agree with Erica. I don't think this is going to dramatically change the character of neighborhoods. And I think in a lot of cases it can make it more affordable for families who are trying to keep a house, because now they can, you know, make an upstairs, downstairs maybe, and bring a renter in downstairs, or maybe build something over the garage and have somebody chip in to pay the rent, where they do say, okay, we're going to tear down this old house and build maybe, you know, two houses or a duplex. It's not like that's not happening now. It's not like there's no, you know, redevelopment going on now. And I don't think that's not even close to the same thing as throwing up a big apartment. I think that I really think these are needed. The reality is there's demand, and it's growing, and there's people that want to move to this area, and they're going to. So the question is, where do they show up? Do they show up in Seattle, where the infrastructure is, or do they show up in Duval and Carnation and Kent and Auburn? And just like the mayor was saying, you know, do they have longer commutes, more greenhouse gas, and really a community and a you know, county that doesn't operate the way it should, which is, you know, the Growth Management Act. We really had this debate about 20 years ago with the Growth Management Act. And the question was, do you put the growth in the urban areas where the infrastructure is, or do you just keep going further out and further out into the rings of the suburbs? And the decision was, and we kind of all agreed, let's put it in the urban areas. And now that's happening in Seattle. And so for the past 20 years, most of the growth has actually shown up in the suburbs.
Well, in a few minutes, we're going to get a little more at that. Like, why not send them all to Kirkland, for example? But where Bill Finkbeiner lives. But first, I want to ask Knute, what's the worst thing about living near more duplexes and mother-in-law units?
Well, I don't have a problem with that. I'm in a renter. I'm in a big apartment complex in the middle of a single-family neighborhood. I'm not opposed to that. I think that there are a lot of problems, macroeconomic problems, that we need to wrestle along with dealing with these zoning issues, one of which is, when Seattle went through its, you know, big boom at the turn of the century, the people who moved here were laborers, and they built their own bungalows, and they, you know, occupied those houses, and that was the affordable housing of that era. Now we have, you know, influxes of very affluent single people, mostly white. Amazon has been criticized for its hiring practices and the sort of sociological effect. we need to do something about that. We need to respond in some way to what the market wants. I don't think that the market always wants the right thing. You know, another interesting thing, and one reason I like the idea of people dividing their homes, I love the idea of the old rooming houses or boarding houses and people dividing their homes into duplexes. I'm fine with that. I'm fine with backyard cottages, you know. But one of the trends that we're fighting is the fact that I did a back of the envelope thing. If you somehow could add half a person per household in Seattle to every household, or even half the households, you would accommodate all that growth in the next 20 years. I mean, just on paper, just theoretically. And we would still have fewer people per house than we had in 1960. So I think the idea of finding creative strategies for sort of repopulating existing structures and existing housing should be part of this, part of this plan. I'm skeptical that the stuff that will get built will really end up being affordable. I would like to see more public money spent on building affordable housing, and I'd like to see the city use eminent domain or whatever it has to make sure that that is spread throughout the city in a fair way.
Erica C. Barnett actually... it's audible when she raises her eyebrows. You can actually hear it. It's great radio. Erica, what's your problem with that?
Well, I think building more affordable housing funded by the city is a great idea, and in fact, that's in the plan. Ed Murray proposed doubling the housing levy, which I think is a huge step forward, and I think that we should approve that when it comes up. One thing I didn't hear is any reason, and I rarely hear any reason or any honest reason about why people want to preserve single family zoning as it is.
What do you think the honest reason is?
I think one honest reason that some people do is because they think it preserves their property values. And I mean, I've heard many times from people in the neighborhoods that they don't want that going in next door because it's going to hurt their property values, whatever that is.
And what's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with that is...
You would expect people to not want their property values to...
Well, first of all, I think they're wrong. I don't think it will decrease their property values to have new neighbors. And I think it's an exclusionary attitude that, you know, that just won't work in a city that's going to grow by 120,000 people. We're not going to get the demographics of the 1960s again. That's just, we can try to socially engineer that all we want, but people aren't having as many kids, and we can't add a half person to every household. What we can do is slightly increase the single family areas, while I mean, the other thing that doesn't get talked about as much in this plan is to upzone multifamily areas across the city, so you know, so that developers can get you know an extra story or two. That is a big aspect of the plan. But you know, when people talk about accommodating growth, that growth has to go everywhere. It can't just go in multifamily areas. We can't you know redline poor people out of single family areas just because we don't want them there. We being you know homeowners and property owners. And I'm not saying that's the motivation of everyone, but it is one that I've heard quite a bit, that, you know, I don't want that thing next to my house.
Okay, so as I said, more to come on affordability and growth in Seattle. I got from Erica, quality of life improved under this HALA plan. Bill Finkbeiner?
I think so, too. I mean, I think, you know, we're not going to go back to the days where people moved to Seattle and built their house. Seattle was a different place. When my great-grandmother, you know, came to this town as a single mom with three kids in whatever, you know, year that was, it was a different place then. It was a different place 50 years ago. It was a different place 20 years ago. And it's going to be a different place in 20 years from now. And I think that's kind of the root of a lot of the opposition to this is change is hard. It's challenging. You know, the big area I grew up on as a kid where we had animals and goats and chickens and ducks and now it's nine houses. It's not the same place it was when I grew up there. But now there's other families that are living there and I think that change is actually going to continue to make Seattle a better place. I think if you look at the alternative where you say let's freeze it in time and make it exactly the same and it'll look exactly the same in 30 years as it does today, well now because the demand is coming, the prices, you know, supply and demand sort of it's a law. And the price of those houses is just going to be absolutely stratospheric. And even if you wanted to say,
that's
okay,
your argument. What your property values are going to boom if we don't do this.
I actually think they're going to be higher if they do institute this for two reasons. Number one, I think it's going to be a better place to live. I think you're going to have more economic and cultural diversity in our neighborhoods. And so I think that's part of what draws, you know, people to urban areas and what will draw them to Seattle. I also think that, basically same supply and demand. If you're able to make, you know, two housing units or three housing units, if you're able to sell your property and say, guess what, you can rent that mother-in-law unit out for an extra, you know, $1,500 a month and help pay the mortgage and your property taxes, that makes it a more affordable place to more people. It makes the value higher.
Okay, we're going to subdivide this conversation and let it sprawl into the another part of the show, but I give the last word to Knut Berger for now.
Yeah, well, Quality of life
under this plan, this proposal.
I think it's unknown. I think it would improve for a lot of people. I think it would create a lot of growth-related problems that we're going to get one way or the other that we need to deal with. I'd love to see the plan subjected to something like an environmental impact statement to see what the problems with it are, what the opportunities are, and what mitigations would be appropriate if there were any required.
We've been talking about this task force appointed by Seattle's mayor releasing its recommendations this week and how the plan might affect our quality of life. And city council members are asking the same question. They're going to have to approve a lot of these ideas, and you'll have your chance to go to your city council and weigh in. On our Facebook page, we asked you what frightens you about Seattle in the wake of the traumatic read that was the New Yorker article on the earthquake possibility. And it was the way growth is happening in Seattle frightens a KOW listener named Patty. She said the potential loss of historic homes and neighborhoods is the scariest thing to her. But we will talk about the scary New Yorker article. Mike on Facebook said, when I got to the part of the New Yorker article where we dropped 6 feet, I looked around at my house and had to stop reading until the next day. How terrified should you be of the really, really big one? We have some answers coming in about 10 minutes on the Weekend Review. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review with Knut Berger, Erica C. Barnett, Bill Finkbeiner. I'm Bill Radke, and we are talking about this affordability report, and we're going to get back at that in a moment. But first, did you hear about the new start date for Bertha? Just out. She's going to start tunneling again November 23rd, the Monday before Thanksgiving. The most unproductive time of the year. Because if anybody is comfortable working for 3 days and then taking a long holiday, it's Bertha the tunneling machine. Tunnel opening now, March 2018. Guaranteed. You know, I have a question. Talking about this, the State Transportation Department, one of the administrators there said, The state is a paying customer in this transaction, and we're intent on getting what we contracted for. And we thought, yeah, you're a little more than a paying customer. I mean, you're the people who hired the folks. Do you feel like that WashDOT is taking enough responsibility, or are they offloading that?
Well, I think their lawyers are telling them to get a 10-foot pole and hold it there. I mean, that, you know, theoretically, the idea of a design-build thing is exactly that. But you've seen, you know, WashDOT continually step back and back and back from the project. They know it's going to end up in years of litigation over hundreds of millions of dollars, and they want it all on the contractor.
I mean, it's not like you just walked into the restaurant and you can't believe how slow the service is. You own the restaurant, you hired the staff, and you plan the menu.
Yeah, that's right.
I think they should have contracted with Sound Transit. Somebody pointed out the other day that Sound Transit will have finished 3 tunnels in the time it took the Bertha to get their one done.
Right.
On time and on budget.
I have nothing to add except, you know, I think that this was all so predictable. Everybody predicted it, and it's coming true. And I love, you know, in some sick way as a journalist and not as, you know, as a WashDOT administrator, I love watching the whole thing fall apart because because we said this was going to happen and no one listened. And now we're seeing the limits of skips out of a design build contract.
More on things falling apart in a few minutes on the Weekend Review, since the I-5 is going to be the new waterfront viaduct. We just don't...
We just have to wait.
Just have to wait, as always. So as I say, this Seattle Committee on Affordability is recommending densifying the city and how to do it to create more homes and cheaper homes so we can accommodate growth. And the question I have for the next few minutes is, why is it so important that Seattle be affordable to everyone, and why is it so important that Seattle do the accommodating of growth? For example, this week, Ross Reynolds talked to a local real estate investor named Richard Hager, who said Seattle doesn't have to take all these people.
How about we encourage more industry, more corporations to move to, like, Everett or Renton, Tacoma? Those are areas that could absorb a lot more growth and do it very easily. I bet you Everett could absorb 125,000 people immediately because they have a very nice downtown core that is underutilized. So, you know, as prices go up, people are forced out. It is that unfortunate thing that has always happened.
Former State Senate Republican Majority Leader Bill Finkbeiner, we are building trains and we have buses and we have places outside Seattle that can accommodate growth.
Sure. So, I mean, I think there's two things. I think one is, you know, I don't think we decide where growth happens. I mean, I think people decide where they want to live. There's lots of cities that would love to have
people. If there aren't enough places to live or people can't afford them, then they go to Everett, Tacoma, Renton, Kirtland.
Or their employers come here, or, you know, it depends on what kind of city you want to be. Again, if you want to be a city where very few middle-class people can afford to live, then, you know, then that's one alternative. But I think, you know, I think what you're, you know, what you're also looking at is, you know, is the kind of place that you want Seattle to be. It really is. It's a type of community you want to have here, and the type of neighborhoods you want to have here. And
well, if it came to a vote, Seattle might vote to be lesser Seattle.
Right. Well, I think it's also happened. I mean, this has happened to some degree over the last 20 years. Since 1990, King County's grown by 33%, and Seattle's only grown by 23%. So we have pushed the growth, or at least the growth has happened in those outer rings. That in the last few development cycles, that is where people move. They said, I want to have a 5-acre house out in Covington or Duval, and they moved out there, Sammamish or Issaquah. And now what's happening is you're seeing two things. One is you're seeing the Growth Management Act kicking in, and we're not allowing people to sort of tear down the next set of forests out there and build a housing development, which I think is good policy. And you're seeing a lot of businesses move into Seattle, and so the demand for housing is growing here. But I think to sort of say, hey, let's keep pushing the development out into further reaches. Let's push it out into North Bend. Let's push it out into Clay Elum. That's bad policy, I think. It's bad policy as a community. I don't think we want to say, okay, our kids, in order to afford a house, are going to have to drive an hour and a half to get to their job. It's bad policy environmentally. The amount of greenhouse gas that's produced by our automobiles, especially on these long commutes, is significant. And
I hear some of those are electric these days.
Yeah, some of them are, I guess. But I think it's bad policy as a community to sort of say that's the type of community that we want to be.
Knute Berger, we are building trains to Redmond and Tacoma, even West Seattle, for God's sake. So why not let some of this growth push elsewhere?
Well, we should. I mean, my thing is that if you're going to work the supply side, which I understand we need more housing, you can also work on the demand side, which is just work more regionally to steer growth to areas that under growth management, under the PSRC planning, under regional planning, are designated as urban zones. In other words, a great example is Federal Way. They're going to be getting it's like the downtown Federal Way right now is like the mall from hell. They want to be
SeaTac Mall, the mall of my youth.
They want to be turn that into a dense urban hub. They've even purchased and built a town commons in the middle that they're hoping will be a catalyst for development down there, redevelopment down there. They're going to get light rail. They have major freeways coming through kind of from every direction. And what did Seattle do? You know, we went down there and we stole Weyerhaeuser for Pioneer Square. We're competing against cities that we should be helping, and we're doing it because we make money doing it. We make money on development, and we make money by attracting these companies to town. And I think, you know, some of that's okay, but we haven't lost that competitive mindset between municipalities in the Puget Sound region. I wrote about this some years ago, that, you know, we were all founded to compete with one another because each city on Puget Sound believed it was going to be the big kahuna. Mm-hmm. Seattle ended up being that big kahuna. But we're still competing with the other cities in a way I think that's not helpful to Seattle, and I don't think it's helpful to the region.
Erica, why don't we distribute the kahunas?
Let me wait for the applause for that idea to die down. Well, gosh, there's a lot of reasons. One is that, I want to get to something Bill said, which is that people move where they want to move. That, to some extent, is true. But people won't move to Seattle if we make it an unaffordable city, which not doing policies that promote growth here will affect. There are consequences to sprawl and saying, oh, well, let's just send everybody to Everett. They'll just take the bus or they'll drive electric cars is
Sound Transit
really
is,
dodging
is asking
issue.
For money to build to Everett.
Well, I actually think that they should build within Seattle first to West Seattle and Ballard. And I think that building on the spine, you know, to get into the weeds a little for a second, to build the spine on I-5 doesn't promote any kind of development. And I actually think that's a bad idea, the way that they're building it. But to get back to the issue of where people should go, you know, we socially engineer everything. That's what government is. We don't live in an anarchist society. And I think that we, you know, if we're going to be developing policies, we should develop policies that do invite companies here and that don't say go to Federal Way, and that acknowledge that people who move to this region want to live, many, many of them want to live in Seattle. And, you know, the policies that we have right now are effectively increasing people's property values through the sky. Directly as a result of the affordable housing crisis. People are benefiting directly from the fact that people like me can't find affordable housing.
We've been talking about why should Seattle take all the growth. And Bill Finkbeiner, do you have a last word?
Yeah, I'd just say that, you know, between 1990 and 2000, the population of King County grew by 500,000. The population of Seattle grew by 120,000. So the majority of the people are not moving to this area and living in Seattle. The majority of the people for the last 20 years have been moving outside of it. But Seattle can't sort of pull up a drawbridge and say, okay, everybody's got to stay out. And I think that, you know, you've seen a tremendous amount. Maybe Everett's looking for more growth, but you've seen a tremendous amount of growth in places like Sammamish, places like Issaquah, places like Duval that have just exploded over the last 20 years, and you know, you talk about a change in those communities. They've grown by 80-90% or more, or a couple hundred percent in some cases. So, you know, I think for Seattle to sort of say, well, but that's good for everybody else, but for us, we want to just sort of lock it in right here, I don't think is, again, the right policy.
Coming up on KUOW, okay, maybe you're going to move here, but do you have the right to be able to park here? Stay tuned for that and more on the Week in Review. Review. I'm Bill Radke, and we are in front of a lovely live audience at University Heights Center. Are you all familiar with where the emergency exits are? This week, Seattleites read an article in New Yorker magazine that caused the plates in our brains to slip under one another. The complacency plate, which had been wedged tightly under the denial plate, suddenly gave way, resulting in a wall of terror that flooded our coast of well-being. So, we have invited Bill Steele from the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network here. Hiya, Bill.
Hey, Bill. Good to see you.
You too. And it was nice knowing you. I have 5 tickets on Delta leaving SeaTac at 1:25 this afternoon, arriving Boise 3:24. My family and I will be homesteading in the safety of Idaho. Why should I not be on that airplane?
Well, it was a very interesting article in The New Yorker. A lot of nice history, some good imagery.
Nice is a good word. Yeah, good imagery.
Yeah, of how we learned of this Cascadia subduction zone, unlike the Japanese who didn't realize they had a magnitude 9 potentially off their northern coast. We know we have magnitude 9s every 500 years on average, and we know a lot about the ground motions that will be produced by that earthquake and the tsunamis that will result. And it doesn't mean panic for Seattle.
How so?
Well,
because when I read the article, it seemed like panic. Let me just imagine this being read aloud by James Earl Jones, if you will. The tsunami will not look like a wave rising up from the surface of the sea. It will look like the whole ocean elevated, overtaking land. A 5-story deluge of pickup trucks and door frames and cinder blocks and fishing boats and utility poles and everything else that once constituted the coastal towns of the Pacific Northwest. By the time the shaking has ceased and the tsunami has receded, the region will be unrecognizable. How accurate is that?
Well, unfortunately, I think the imagery kind of confused what's going to happen immediately on the coast and the very worst-case scenario of what might happen in a specific locale, not generally. And then it sort of inferred that that's going to happen to everything to the west of I-5, including Seattle and Tacoma.
More than inferred, regional FEMA director said, quote, "Our operating assumption is that everything west of Interstate 5 will be toast."
Yeah, well,
how else do you read that? Nope. So,
well, I fully expect. I walked here this morning. I live in a 100-year-old home in the University District, and I think my neighborhood is going to look a lot like it looks now after that earthquake. There are going to be some chimneys toppled. There's going to be certainly some unreinforced masonry structures all around the city that will collapse or be severely damaged. There are going to be pockets of real intense damage and areas where it looks pretty much the way it does today. So the shaking that we expect, the level of shaking, is similar to what we got in Nisqually, maybe a little stronger, and for a longer duration. But it's not the end of the world as we know it.
Unless you're on the coast.
Unless you're on the coast. I have to say, unfortunately, the coast is very vulnerable. We'll get much stronger shaking. And the tsunami that follows could be in the range of, say, 5 meters to 10 meters, something like that, across the average. In some areas, maybe even larger. So you could see a 10, 30-foot wave, depending on where you are and how that energy is focused.
All right. I'm not off my flight yet, but I did get a ticket that I can change. I also have a window seat, though, because I might want to watch everything.
You want to watch.
Yeah. But this article also says that we are unprepared. What's up with our early warning system?
Well, we actually have developed or are in the process of developing an earthquake early warning system. We're testing it now with companies in the city of Seattle and Sound Transit and other agencies. It's working quite well. There's still some. We want to improve the reliability of the system. We need to harden the infrastructure of the network to make sure when we're doing official warnings that they get out to people. And to do that, the USGS needs some support from Congress to make this into an operational system. And about something on the order of about $16 million a year, and now currently there's somewhere around $8 million a year going to the project. So we're getting close to being able to roll out an operational system.
We're going to open it to the panel for reaction here, too. But let me ask you this. Would a smaller than 9-point earthquake be good news because it would relieve some pressure?
Yeah, unfortunately, no. It will relieve some pressure. But generally, when you have, say we have a magnitude 7 in the Cascadia subduction zone, that's going to transfer a lot of strain to kind of locked portions to the north and south of that rupture, and it's going to increase the probability of unzipping the whole thing. So for a while, anyway. So right now it's aseismic. It's very quiet, and that's a little scary, too, that we don't have the smaller earthquakes, we're not probably going to have warning for this earthquake. And if we do, if we had a magnitude 6 or 7 in the Cascadia subduction zone, it would certainly get our attention.
Well put. Get our attention. Yeah. Well, panel, what do you think of the unzipping? Knut, how did you react when you read this article?
Well, I thought that I had to explain it to my mother-in-law, who's staying with us, visiting from Arizona, and you should have seen the look on her face as we, you know, were trying to explain why we were still living here. I also thought it was interesting that the Seattle media reaction was, well, that's all very well true, but the real bad quake is the one they didn't write about, which is the Seattle fault, which is right underneath us, and if that would be even worse.
For Seattle. What about that, Bill?
Why? Yeah, that's very true. I would rather ride through a magnitude 9 Cascadia subduction zone earthquake here in Seattle than a 6.5 Seattle fault earthquake right under my feet. And the reason is that we're going to be at best, or at worst, about 90 kilometers away from the rupture where it comes down. So some of that energy gets attenuated, the high-frequency energy gets attenuated, and so we're going to have moderate shaking here for a long duration. It's going to seem pretty strong, but really compared to what the Earth can produce with a crustal earthquake, it's fairly moderate. So it's worse to have an earthquake right up under your feet.
My suitcase is not unzipped. Erica Barnett, well, how did you react?
I actually loved this article. And my reaction as a writer was, wow, I'm really glad they hired this woman. It's a new writer for New Yorker.
That's how you reacted.
That's how I reacted because, I mean, we know that we live in an earthquake zone. I don't think that Seattle should be shocked at this article. Although I will say I work on the waterfront. And in a very old building that will be, as the FEMA guy said, toast. And
liquefied. Liquid toast, whatever that is.
Well, the ground underneath us will be liquefied, effectively. But, we're all I don't know where our emergency exits are. I don't even know how to use a fire extinguisher. I mean, we're in trouble. And everyone at my work is absolutely flipping out over this. It's kind of terrifying and hilarious.
Terrifying and hilarious. What about you, Bill Finkbeiner?
So didn't you say your work last week required a recycling seminar that everybody had to attend, but they haven't had the one yet to show you how to use the fire extinguishers, huh?
Priorities.
I think that's my personal fault.
It's probably a good reminder for us all to be prepared for the, what do they say, 2 weeks, right?
I think, week to two is a good plan.
It's probably a good plan.
In the chaos after the quake, what happens to Seattle civility? Are we at that point, are we any more civil than anyone else?
I think that we are sort of on our own, constant subduction zone with civility. And, it's just always about to break. So I think I predict anarchy.
I disagree. I think people will pull together and neighborhoods will pull together and that we'll really have a proud moment as we try to put things back together again.
Yeah. You are an optimist.
I like that. Well, I feel a little better about the 2 weeks. I've heard of doomsday preppers. We're sort of doomsday hoarders at our house. So we've got a couple of cabinets there that should be able to last us. Dig back in and find an old box of Rice Krispies. Last a couple of
weeks.
Even
if you don't have an emergency shelter, you presumably have a couple of weeks' worth in your pantry, right?
We hope. For sure.
I will say, just to loop these two topics together, that renters like me don't have 2 weeks of supplies because there's no room.
No room.
Yeah, that's pretty elitist of me to assume.
I've often thought it was funny that, not humorous funny, but that, and I've written about this over the years, about how we're worried about a big quake and a possible disaster. We've done everything possible by building traffic circles and everything to make sure evacuation is impossible.
Well, I think the New Yorker story just said run uphill. You won't have time to get in your car.
Well, and that's an important point, too, is that we're not going to have a big tsunami issue here in Seattle. A very small amount of the tsunami energy will make it down the Strait of Juan de Fuca. So we're going to have really unusual currents. Marinas will be dangerous. If there's a landslide into the Sound, that could generate a bit of a wave. So good to pull back from the water. But there's not going to be a tsunami inundating downtown Seattle. That's not on the agenda whatsoever.
Here are some comforting words on Facebook from Travis. I'm less worried about surviving the initial quake and possible tsunami and more about the destruction of roads, power, water, sewage, gas, communication, supply lines, outbreaks of disease, and massive economic collapse for a few years afterwards. That's what we're talking about, right? It's not really, we all know we're going to die. It's not, for me, it's not so much the fear of being overwhelmed, it's kind of that nightmare scenario. It's like being scared of, it's being terrified of how terrifying it's going to be. Do you know what I mean?
It sounds Katrina-esque to me. I mean, that's what it really reminded me of. My family's from Houston, and when everybody sort of evacuated New Orleans and a lot of them stayed in Houston, you know, I can see a scenario like that here where we all maybe move to Boise.
See?
Yes, we also can build structures that can withstand this earthquake and even a Seattle fault earthquake right underneath our feet. The engineers can really do a phenomenal job. And it only costs maybe 5% more to build above the code minimum code standard, so the buildings will be usable after the earthquake and not just life safety requirements. And so we need to be thinking about how do we build a more resilient community, how do we build a more resilient city and state, and work that in. And on the coast, they have to start thinking about vertical evacuation in seaside and ocean shores and areas where people don't have any viable options to get out of the tsunami floodplain.
Okay, then, so beyond thinking about it, what should we do as citizens with
invest.
The danger?
We have to be willing to invest in strengthening our infrastructure.
So telling our elected officials what?
That it's important to us that we live through this thing and that we have a job when it's over, and that we want to see our bridges strengthened. And if you're living on the coast, that you might want to be paying a little bit more property tax to be able to evacuate to the roof of the gymnasium and be out of the tsunami floodplain. I mean, these are things that, just are kind of no-brainers, and we haven't done them yet.
Here's another different perspective, again, on our Facebook page. We asked you about this. Mike says, it's too big to even be afraid of, and who doesn't secretly want to begin again, rise out of the rubble? Like, there are stakes again to life. Wouldn't it be fascinating? That's one way to look at it.
Well, and I think, families and folks that are somewhat prepared and have thought this through, and I know space is difficult for water. You have to kind of put the closet, fill the bottom of it, and put the shoes on top of the water.
I'm sorry, what closet?
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, the apartments have even more trouble. But having that, those supplies, having your medicine for 30 days, whatever, you can have a great adventure for a week, or you could really have a hellacious time keeping your family with water and food. So the little things we do now will make a huge difference later.
We've been talking about a New Yorker article this week that told you what you already knew and didn't want to think about. By the way, Marley says, my greatest threat is my daily bike commute. How's that for an endorsement of cycling from Marley? We are going to talk on the Week in Review about whether your government has the right to peek into your bins in just a few minutes. So Bill Steele from the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network, thank you for enlightening us.
Thank you, Bill.
Back to KUOW's Week in Review, framing, debating, discussing, learning from the week gone by. I'm Bill Radke. In light of this week's New Yorker article describing the impending 9-point earthquake that will turn your home into a hellscape of terror and death, we asked you on Facebook what scares you most about living in Seattle, and Laura said, finding parking near the Ballard Sunday Market, as is the wait list to get into Walrus and Carpenter. I figure we're mostly going to die in the big one anyway, so wasting my precious time finding a parking spot is distressing. There's the big picture worry, and then there's the dang, I can't find a place to put my car. So I wonder how Laura feels about this week's report from the Mayor's Housing Affordability Committee, which recommends doing away with, is it all requiring home builders to provide parking? Doing away with all of that, or just reducing
It's doing away with it in certain areas.
Erica, we want to discourage car use, but we still drive cars. What should we do about parking?
We do still drive cars. All this proposal does is say, if you're a developer, hey, You don't have to build parking if there isn't demand for it. You'll notice that most
What if there is demand for it?
Well, people build parking, and you'll notice that most new developments do have parking. These, you know, some of these small micro-housing developments don't. There aren't very many of those anymore, thanks to new rules that Hollywood also overturned. But I was looking at the new PCC development down in Columbia City, and it has, you know, parking for every resident. You do have to pay for it. And that's what's, I think that's what's really more common. Getting rid of government mandates that you build a certain amount of parking increases, those mandates increase the cost of housing. And all this is saying is those mandates aren't necessary. They're not saying we're taking your parking away.
Canute Berger?
Well, I see some of the logic in what Eric is saying about the developers not necessarily having to build parking and making that kind of a market issue. I think it's problematic. I'm more concerned personally about the taking away of public parking in places like downtown. And I think that there's an assumption that we can all live without cars, and it's just not true. And a lot of us do need cars for our work and that kind of a thing. So I think there is a war on parking. The city's already eliminated, over 1,000 street spaces in just recent years. And I'd like to see there's some kind of counterbalance. I'd actually like to see underground public parking downtown in areas to kind of ameliorate the problems that are down there now.
What's wrong with that, Erica?
Well, we do have lots of downtown parking. In fact, most of the parking in lots that are priced at market rate is not being used. So there's actually plenty of parking downtown. It might not be on the street. You might not want to drive into a garage and pay $15, but that's the market rate. And, you know, I think it's interesting when you hear people say...
But you're worried about affordability and elitism, so you can have a car if you can afford to park it.
Well, people who... first of all, no, you don't have to drive downtown. Fortunately, we have a very downtown-centric transit system that gets you there pretty easily from most parts of the city, 95% of the city, I would say. Additionally, what I was going to say is I think it's interesting that people who don't want changes in single-family neighborhoods, you know, and elsewhere say we have more than enough capacity and more than enough development capacity to build for all the people that are coming here. But when you say we actually also have enough parking capacity for all the cars that are going to come here, which we do, they don't believe you. And, I mean, that is a demonstrable fact that may not seem clear when you're driving around the block and you're frustrated. But we actually have plenty of parking, and downtown is a great example. We have plenty of parking there. And insider tip, the Pacific Place garage is cheap, and it has a motorcycle rate.
You know
which
what?
I use. Our meter is expiring on this show. I don't want to leave it aside. Can we talk about the privacy lawsuit regarding the garbage bins? Because I just want to get maybe a quick take. Some people are suing the city of Seattle. Remember that the city said if you put too many compostables and recyclables in your garbage bin, we will flag you. We'll charge you a buck for a home and $50 for an apartment building. Some people are suing the city, saying, "Get out of my garbage cans!" Even the police need a warrant to snoop in my cans. What's your take?
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Gary Hart, right? Going through his
snooping,
garbage.
Yeah.
But I'm just glad I was for it, and then I took the quiz on your webpage and got 2 out of 10, and so now I'm against it.
Canute, bin snoopers?
No, I'm against that.
Against which? The snooping or the
lawsuit?
I think
they should keep their nose out of individuals' garbage.
How are they going to enforce it? I don't understand how this law is enforceable if garbage people can't go in and just take a peek.
Bingo.
I mean, that would make it completely unenforceable. I will say there has been tremendous compliance with this law. And I think, which we know based on people looking into people's garbage cans, and I think that actually this is a temporary problem, because I think people, once they learn what to compost, and once they take your quiz and learn what can be recycled and et cetera, they'll they'll get on board and we won't have to snoop.
Maybe they could
garbage.
Make a privacy screen, or it could be like when you go through the airport where one person holds a camera and somebody remotely looks at it so they don't know whose garbage it is.
You want to take 2 minutes and do the recycling quiz from KUOW.org?
Sure.
I got 3.5 out of 9. It was humiliating. Yeah. So orange peel with a sticker, I said compost. Now, I'm going to give myself a half a point because I assumed I was going to just take the sticker off. It's not that, right? Yeah.
I didn't know this was a self-graded quiz.
Yeah, I self-graded this one answer. The correct answer was trash because of the sticker, so peel it off and compost it. Parmesan plastic container. So we have, you know, Chinese restaurant, whatever, a food-contaminated plastic container. I said recycle it.
Clean it and recycle it.
The quiz said trash because as it's dirty, but then how much water do you flood a peanut butter jar before you?
Bill, isn't this your quiz essentially?
Sort of. Okay.
Who are you
Fair
blaming
enough.
Here?
I'm always blaming someone else. How about hair? I said compost.
Compost.
Trash.
Garbage.
Yeah.
Trash. How'd you know that? Can you of all people? You're a hair expert.
Oh, amazing amounts of hair. Yes.
Plastic fork. I got this one right.
Clean and recycle?
Yeah, recycle. I didn't even say clean. I was too lazy for that. I just said recycling, which is correct. Don't worry about the numbers. Pill bottle. I said recycle a pill bottle.
Everybody's saying no.
Trash? Because it's too brittle for recycling? Everybody knew that but me? Too brittle? Do you have a brittleness indicator on your right above your sink? Okay, water bottle cap. I knew this one. See, Erica, you thought it was recycle, right?
I did, but then I saw a note on this water bottle here, and I know the answer as of 5 minutes ago.
It's because those tiny little caps jack up the gears in the machinery. So it's the 3-inch rule. Okay, paper with tape. I said trash because I assume we're going to keep the tape on it. You can't recycle tape. It's recycling. I pull the tape off. Seriously, I stand there. Do you do that too? I'll pull the tape off a cardboard, like an Amazon delivery, whatever. And because I'm such a do-gooder.
Any kind of tape? That's. Did you ask the quiz what kind of tape they're talking about?
I can't ask the quiz. Okay, last one. We got 30 seconds. Snotty tissue. I said recycling.
Trash.
It's trash. I didn't know. What have I done? I've contaminated Seattle. I'm so sorry. Bill Finkbeiner, State Senate Majority Leader. Erica C. Barnett, the C is for crank.com. Knute Berger, the Mossback from Seattle Weekly, from a Crosscut. Sorry. Thank you, everybody. Thank you to our live audience, University High Center. We're going to be at the Leif Erickson in Ballard a week from today. Jason Pagano produces the show. See you next week.